We're in a diner, and a beautiful woman approaches a booth where superhero Luke Cage is seated.
Luke.
Yes.
Oh, you probably don't remember me, do you? Your girlfriend had me take care of you when you were brought into the hospital. In Hell's Kitchen.
Hey. Hey.
So he doesn't recognize her, but she's clearly figured out a little something about him.
You didn't have to do what you did for me.
Have you ever saved anyone's life before? More than once, I'm betting.
So?
So the only thing you can think about afterwards is if they're okay. That's all I wanted to know.
Well, I'm still here.
How? That shotgun blast alone should have turned your brain into mush.
So I'm a freak.
No. You're amazing.
I don't want to be different than anybody else.
Why hide it? I mean, what are you going to do with it?
What indeed will this black superhero in a hoodie do with his superpower, bulletproof skin? That's the big question in episode 6 of the Netflix Marvel series Luke Cage, written by Kansas City native Nathan Lewis Jackson. He's back in town as a writer in residence for the KC Rep, but his real claim to fame at the moment is writing for a superhero who stands out in the Marvel Comics world. Luke Cage is an ex-con, but not a criminal. You won't see him in spandex or capes. He wears street clothes. And yes, his race sets him apart. How does the writer's own past here in town shape the character audiences are loving on screen? I'm Gina Kaufman, and today's Central Standard on KCUR is a portrait session with Nathan Lewis Jackson. Hey, Nathan, how's it going?
Good. How are you?
Good. Was it fun for you to listen to that scene?
It was. I was thinking about where I was, because when I remember when I first watched it, I'm thinking I was outside in the video village, we call it. I was outside sipping coffee. It was so cold. And I was just kind of watching them shoot the scene, and it was fun. It kind of took me back a little bit.
You were standing outside the diner looking in?
I was outside because the diner is not a big diner, so I could have been inside, but there's a lot more room outside actually. So it's not like it looks like it's very spacious when you're watching, but it's not spacious at all. It's not a very big diner. So
the music really sets a tone there, and it sets a pace. I mean, I'm sure our listeners noticed this is not a quick repartee. This was a slow, thoughtful, a lot going on under the surface kind of exchange.
Yeah. And we had to, because they were talking about some things, those two characters were talking about things that happened in the previous series, in the Jessica Jones series. That's the first time, I guess we meet her in the episode before, but in that episode, that's the first episode her and Luke, Claire and Luke meet since they've met in Jessica Jones. So there was a lot of stuff we had to get out in that one, and we had to take our time to kind of catch up and kind of start setting up their relationship.
Tell me about Luke Cage in your own words.
Oh, man. The character, because I when I grew up, I remember loving superheroes. I wasn't as familiar with Luke Cage and the character himself.
He debuted in the 70s.
In the 70s, and there wasn't a lot of Luke Cage comic books. But looking back now, and even more once I got the job, we just realized how much potential there was with this character, just with the simple fact of what his powers were, the strength and the unbreakable skin, living in the world we're living in today. So he's a fantastic character to write for, because there's so much there with his past, with being in prison, being falsely accused. It's so much meat there for a writer.
Tell us a little bit more about his past.
A lot of that is in episode 4, but basically he was a former cop who was falsely accused and then sent to prison. and prison is where he gets his powers. He's kind of preyed upon by this prison guard who wants him to do these weird street fights in prison for, you know, some of the guards gamble and bet on the fights, and he does them, and that's how he learns how to be a great fighter. But when he kind of crosses that guard, the guard gets kind of peed off and attacks him, beats him up, and to save his life, a doctor basically runs an experiment on him. The experiment goes wrong, but wrong in a good way, and that's how he gets his powers. Breaks out of prison, and booyah, you got Luke Cage. So, you know, as we see him, he's doesn't want anybody to kind of know his past, because his past will lead him back to Seagate, to the prison.
There's some dispute as he moves on into the world about whether he's, I mean, among the public, people don't know his identity, but they know that there's someone out there doing some stuff, as is usually the case with a superhero. But there's some dispute about whether this is a good character or a bad character.
Mm-hmm. Which are always the best characters when it's not cut and dry and clear if they're good or bad. I think he's definitely a good character, but just like all of us, he has many different layers. And there are times when, for him at least, he doesn't want to be that guy. He doesn't want to be that superhero, that role model, but he realizes at one point that there's, you know, you don't have a choice. So I wouldn't necessarily call him an anti-hero, but I do think that, again, there are many.
He's a reluctant hero.
He's definitely a reluctant hero. And there are times when he goes about getting what he wants, he doesn't necessarily go about it there's some questionable actions that he has. We'll put it like that.
When you say go about getting what he wants, what kind of stuff does he want? Without spoiling specifics, but I mean, what kinds of situations is he inclined to intervene in?
At first, he just wants to be left alone. He says that earlier on. He just kind of wants to regroup, get his head straight, figure out where his place in the world is. And then this city that he's lived in and the people that he starts to meet and have close ties to, these people are preyed upon by whatever antagonist we have in the show, whether it be Cottonmouth or Mariah or just the city itself. He wants to protect these people. He wants to protect the people that he's met, the people he cares about.
The ordinary people of the city.
The ordinary people of the city. The city itself, the love he has for Harlem, the love he has for New York.
So his appearance is really interesting. I mean, in the world of comic book superheroes, mm-hmm. he has no spandex, no cape. Can you talk to me about that?
We definitely want to make him more of a grounded character. If you look at like you said, the character was invented in the 70s. There are some issues with that 70s costume. Some people love it. Some people love the nostalgia of it. We did not.
What are the issues with that 70s superhero costume?
It gets a little bit like, you know, we're watching a black exploitation, you know, thing. And if that's what you like, that's great. We didn't. We wanted to bring him into 2015, I guess, 2016, and a character that people today could better connect to. So instead of having him wear a giant yellow jacket or giant yellow shirt with this, you know, handcuffs and this tiara and these bell-bottom jeans, it was a hoodie and a t-shirt. He felt like someone that we connect to, somebody we know.
The hoodie has taken on sort of sociological significance.
Yeah, yeah.
Can you talk to me? I mean, you said yourself that there's a lot of power just right now in this idea of a black superhero who has unbreakable skin.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, the hoodie's been a thing. I have a hoodie on right now. I wasn't even thinking about, you know, I wasn't trying to make a social comment.
I often have on a hoodie,
super
too.
Super warm. Then I put the hoodie on my head, the hoodie part. Now my head is warm.
It's a useful garment.
It's fantastic. But now we live in a world where that means something else. And that's a dangerous thing. And a lot of people will tell you that African-American men who wear these hoodies are putting themselves in a position of danger just for wearing a hoodie. So there's something about this very powerful character who, you know, rebels against that and uses this as his costume. This is who he is. And it, in a sense, gives strength to other black men across the country to say, hey, it's okay to wear the hoodie. Luke's wearing it, I guess, you know. And there's some things that we do with the hoodie in the episodes that I think is fantastic, especially towards the end. But without spoiling that, it's you have to catch it yourself. I won't even ruin it for you.
I feel like there are questions in so many of the episodes about who is virtuous and who is heroic. And the it's kind of, for several characters, muddied, you know, whether this person is a hero or, I wouldn't say, a villain.
Yeah. No. Again, those are the best ones. We don't want things to be clear or black and white. We want them to be, because I think, for instance, with some of our, if you would call them bad guys, our antagonists, there's a certain compassion that I think that we can bring, that we have for some of these characters, despite some of the horrible things that we do. Because despite, I think the worst bad guys are the ones that just do things because they're bad and they're evil, versus a guy who we can look back in his past and see how he, see the things that happened to him and what caused him to go down this negative path and what causes him, the hurt that he experienced, now we see that's why he puts that hurt out into the world. How, you know, that negativity begets negativity. It helps us better understand the character. And for your heroes, these super squeaky clean guys who don't make any, it's hard to connect to those guys because we all make mistakes. So you got to have characters, or your good guys make mistakes. Your heroes have to have their flaws as well.
There's a character in episode 6, which I hear was one that you were really, really deeply involved in, who is a councilwoman. And
yes,
she, I think, is one of the, she's a really ambiguous character. Uh-huh. Can you talk a little bit about her and maybe kind of, yeah, what you were thinking about with that character?
Man, that's a good, because that character is that, if, I think you're talking about Mariah.
Right.
Yeah, she's a version of her is in the comic books, and we kind of took that out and made it our own again. And even more when we found out that Alfre Woodard would be playing that character. I'm a huge, even before this, I'm a huge Alfre Woodard fan. Huge. I love Alfre Woodard. So to envision this character now, you know, Chael walks, our showrunner walks into the room and says, hey, man, Alfre's in. Alfre's going to play this character. Then the possibilities just open up because you know how talented she is and how much I respect her. So that was a character I was so anxious and so ready to dig into, and so complex. She's probably, as you said, one of the more complex characters that we have in this, because I do believe that she, everything she does is, in her mind, is for a positive reason. She's trying to make a positive impact on the community, and she's fighting her past, which is her, you know, this kind of seedy, shady things that her grandmother and her uncle did. And she doesn't want to become them. She wants to be a positive influence on the community. But
yeah, to lift
in fighting
up
that,
the people of Harlem. And,
yeah. In fighting that, she becomes that eventually, in a way. So, and again, just watching Alfre make that transition was just beautiful. Even more beautiful than I could have imagined, actually. She just did a fantastic job.
A lot of what you do for that character in this episode is really in facial expression and tone of voice, mm-hmm. in an exchange that happens between her and a television news reporter. Mm-hmm. And I understand how you write dialogue. I don't know if I fully grasp how you go about writing a subtext into a scene that is based on really subtle facial expression and body language, mm-hmm. and those kinds of things. Because as this reporter is asking her increasingly uncomfortable questions, you see in her face that she is not only uncomfortable because she's being called out, she's uncomfortable because she is seeing herself.
Right.
You know?
Right. The oh man, let me try to give you the short answer there. There's a couple different ways to do that. The easy way that I don't prefer is to just write that in. You could say you know, the reporter asks a question, and then you write in Mariah Dillard squirms in her seat. She looks uncomfortable. That's kind of telling the actor what to do, and sometimes actors don't like that, and that doesn't get you there the way the other option is. And the other option is to layer that throughout this script. It's just a matter of us as writers making sure that that character is rock solid and that character is so three-dimensional and we know that character head to toe. That way, when the reporter comes in and she asks the questions, Alfrey, as an actor, already understands what she needs to do. She understands that is going to be an uncomfortable question because she knows who she's dealing with. You don't have to tell her that. You don't have to tell her to squirm in her seat. She's already going to get there. So it's some of that, too, and layering that throughout this entire series.
Is this show in conversation with The Wire at all?
I think a little bit. I think a lot of us writers were fans of The Wire, of course. So I think there's a layer of that. You know, you have to be careful not to do what they're doing, and it's two different shows. But there's a lot of similarities with The Wire and with this show that are hard to ignore. So I could say that was an influence. I personally tried not to think about that when I was writing. I tried to make our own show, but I think that was a bit of an influence.
How did you come to be a writer for Luke Cage?
The guy, again, Chael, who runs the show, fantastic guy. I met Chael when I was writing for Southland. That was my first writing job on television with Southland, and I met him there. And since then, we've just remained friends and kind of joked that if one of us ever got a show, we'd call the other one and put him on staff. And he got the show before I did. So he called me the minute he got the opportunity and said, "Hey, man, you know, I want you to write for the show." I'm the kind of guy that's always like, "I'm of course, great. Let me see the contract first." And he came through like he said he was, and that was that. As TV jobs go, this was one of those who you know kind of a thing. It was pretty easy.
Well, if you have a question or observation about Luke Cage for Kansas City writer Nathan Lewis Jackson, send those our way on Twitter. We'll ask those for you later in the show. We're at KCURCST. You can call us at 816-235-2888. But again, we won't be getting to those for a while because now we're going to learn more about Nathan Lewis Jackson's background. Does your background growing up in KCK influence your characters, this character, Luke Cage, at all?
A little bit. I think so. I think it's not just KC, but the part of KC I grew up in.
What part of KC?
Yeah. I grew up in Wyandotte County, which is definitely predominantly Black. So there are some similarities, even though Luke Cage isn't in Kansas City, but he is in Harlem. He is in a predominantly Black neighborhood, which is where I grew up in. There are definitely some similarities there. And some of the issues that he's dealing with, I remember growing up dealing with.
Such as?
Some of the issues with violence, I would say. Some of the issues that they're dealing with guns. Him working at a restaurant. I worked at a restaurant before I was a writer. The way just wanting to be left alone at times, you feel like that. I felt like that. Not as if I love this city. I live here now. I plan to hopefully rest my bones here in this city. But I think like everybody, sometimes your city gets on your nerves. And sometimes you just need a break. And I think like Luke, I just wanted to at times just be by myself and be left alone. I was left alone, I was writing. But that's, I just wanted to take, you know, to have my own little space.
Okay, you love Kansas City, and I think we've established that, so I don't want this to seem like I'm just prodding for the negative. I am curious when Kansas City gets on your nerves and you want it to leave you alone.
Oh, tons of times.
What is it?
It's like family. Like Kansas City is like family, and
I love you. Go away.
Yeah, go. I love you. Go away. Mostly, I love you. But there are times when you just need to. Even my children, I'm going off the rail here a little bit. But even my children, I have children now, and I love my children more than anything. But I was just talking to a friend of mine. There are times you just don't want to be a dad. Like you can't help it. You have to be a dad all the time. But there's sometimes you want to say, they're like, "Daddy, daddy, daddy, daddy." And he was like, "You know what? My name is Nathan. My name is not daddy. I will not be daddy for the next 5 minutes. It's gonna be 5 minutes to be me." And Kansas City is like that in a sense where you're like, hey, Kansas City, I love you, but this thing is getting on my nerves. Sometimes it may be politics. Sometimes it may be the things I love about the people in the city here. Sometimes, like, for instance, the dialogue and the way people speak. People speak a certain way in Kansas City that I love and I put in my scripts. There are times where the way people speak in Kansas City gets on my nerves.
How do people speak in Kansas City?
Oh, the other day someone said the pop. I don't know why it annoyed me, pop, instead of soda. I grew up saying pop, but no one says pop anywhere else, it feels like, except in the Midwest. And that's a little thing that annoyed me. That's very small. Sometimes the racial divide annoys me in Kansas City, and it's everywhere. It's everywhere. But we work in, I work over by the Rep, Kansas City Rep, which is right off of Truce. And it seems like one side of Truce is one thing and one side of Truce is another thing, right? And I love going down to the plaza. I love shopping in the plaza. I love going down the other side of Truce. I get my hair done over there. I got people over there. So I love both sides. But the fact that there's this huge divide is annoying. And I don't like it. I don't like it. But I wouldn't be anywhere else. So it's a weird duality.
There, you mentioned that you had worked in a restaurant. I've heard that you worked in some Kansas City barbecue joints.
I did. I worked. He still has a spot too, Ricky's Pit, which he's moved several places. But I used to work for Rick for several years, and then I went to. There's one here now, but the one I actually worked at was in Manhattan, Kansas, because I went to Kansas State. Famous Dave's for several years. And those are the two big ones that I worked for was Ricky's here and Famous Dave's. But, you know, growing up, eating barbecue and going to several places here as well. But those are the two I worked for. And for several years I worked for that. Before I became a writer, before I left to New York, I was very close to, like, forgetting about writing and just becoming, like, a manager of a restaurant. Because I said, this is what I've been doing for 4 or 5 years. I guess this is it because the writing thing isn't working right now. So,
when the writing thing wasn't working, what was that like for you?
It was tough. It was real tough. It was tough. It was like being in like a little box, and looking outside of this box and just kind of watching the world kind of go by. And I'd have friends in New York, I'd have friends, and they'd be doing things, and I'd be stuck in my little box smoking ribs and, you know, scooping out cornbread muffin mix, and, you know, every day I'd come home. It was weird because it would take me so long to get ready for work because I didn't want to go in, and then I would get off and I would smell like food, and I'd be covering food, and I'd have to put my clothes, my wife would tell me to put my clothes in a bag and then shower, and then, like, it felt like it wasn't just getting off of work, it was coming down off of that. So even though I spent 8 hours at work, I spent another 2 hours coming down from that or getting ready for that, and I had no time to write. All the energy was sucked out of me. And there was some good stuff I didn't realize at the time that I got from work that I put in scripts. There were characters, there were guys I met that ended up going to stories I wrote, but at the time, I didn't see that. It was tough.
Nathan Lewis Jackson, we're going to get back to this conversation after the break. We'll hear how his story turned around from there and a little bit more about those early years when we return. I'm Gina Kaufman. This is KCUR Central Standard. I'm Gina Kaufman. This is KCUR Central Standard, and we're doing a portrait session with Nathan Lewis Jackson. That means that later on when we put this interview online, it'll also be paired with photographs by Paul Andrews, so you'll have your photographic portraits as well. Nathan is in town as the writer in residence for the KC Rep. He's a KCK native, and he's been getting a lot of acclaim for the series he's been co-writing, Luke Cage. That's on Netflix. But we were just talking about his background in KCK. Where exactly in Kansas City, Kansas, did you grow up?
Wyandotte County. I grew up right off of the Quindaro area, like 27th and Quindaro.
There's a certain narrative, I feel like, about Quindaro in Kansas City,
mm-hmm.
that people refer to it as kind of being in ruins at this point.
Mm-hmm.
I wonder how you feel about that.
It's tough because I've heard it like that, and it's not, because there's still a lot of people that live there. It's not as if it is a ghost town. I have lots of family that still live there, so it's still alive. But I feel like the people there are still there. The people there are still alive. Are there less houses in the sense of there was a house here that my buddy used to live in, and now there's just an empty lot, and we see several of that? Yes. Are the businesses alive and vital? No, that's the issue too. And I think that's the problem. Or even in the sense of, you talk about ruins, I was talking to a friend of mine about, said something about John Brown. I was like, you know, the John Brown statue over there, and there's this next to this building where it used to be a university. It was like an all-black university, and then you got the parts of the Underground Railroad over there. All that's there. Like, all that's there. That's a very important part of not just the history of that community, but the history of the city, the history of this nation. It's all right there.
Yeah, the structures are there.
The structure is there. And I hope that they remain there. You know, I know it's been talks of trying to revitalize that, but it's alive. It's a history there in that community, and people are there in that community. So when people say ruins, I don't know if I want to say ruins. It's not dead, but it's not what it used to be when I grew up there, and I don't think it's what it could be.
What was it like when you grew up there?
It felt more. I remember even during the day, like when I went outside, all my friends were outside. We were all outside playing, and there were houses and there were people in there, and they weren't all, you know, they didn't have the most money, but they were there. People were there, and there were kids there. And now when I go there, when I stop by and see my mother, I don't see quite as much of the life as I see, that I used to see there. There aren't quite as many businesses and as many, even like a grocery store, for God's sake. My mother has to travel, I don't know how many miles out just to go get groceries. And that's an issue. I wish that wasn't the case.
You're back as a writer in residence for the KC Rep, but this isn't your first return to Kansas City. And I'm going to get back to your departure, but I bring this up now because the Rep staged one of your original plays, Brokeology, a few years ago. In that play, there's a brother who's stayed behind in Kansas City, Kansas, working low-pay service jobs while taking care of his ailing father. And there's a character who's a scientist. That character left Kansas City behind in hopes that he can make a difference in the world through success in his chosen field, that being science. Success that he doesn't think he can achieve in Kansas City, Kansas. Tension sort of predictably arises between these two, and the brother who's moved on is really torn up about whether he's doing the right thing, leaving his community behind. Is that a dilemma that you have faced?
Yes, it was. The kind of mirroring the play, it's come and go, that dilemma. The time I felt it the strongest was when my father was ill. My father did have MS. And there was a question in my mind of, should I be off? Because at the time I was in college. Should I be in college? Should I be off away? Or should I be back helping out my dad? The difference in, I think the biggest difference with those characters in my situation was the mother. In that play, the mother is not there. In this play, my mother was not only there, but very instrumental. And she would not allow me to do that. And she was holding down camp. To come back. We even kind of had the conversation, and she said she got it. And she did a great job, and she took care of things. But there was still a strong urge for me to stay behind and take care of family and try to handle things back here. Almost to the point, to this day, there's still a little bit of guilt. There's still a little bit of guilt that I did not do that. That when my father was in my father's last days, I was off living my dream.
Tell me about your dream. I mean, when did it begin?
It probably was for a while. I mean, I think growing up, my mother said, I think I said I wanted to be a stand-up comedian / engineer. I think the only reason I said engineer was they told me that
a comedian
didn't make any money. And I was like, oh, okay, well, I'll just be an engineer too. But I didn't really want to be an engineer. And then it was an actor at one point. I acted for several years. And then that turned into a writer. And that probably happened around K-State, around my undergrad years. I just realized there was something about telling your own story versus someone else's.
You ultimately left Kansas City to pursue that dream under pretty intense circumstances. You were accepted into a program at Juilliard, kind of a big deal, but right after your daughter was born.
Yeah, that was tough times. That was, what was that? It was 07 she was born. And I was working at the barbecue restaurant. And I went into work that day. And I didn't think I was getting into Juilliard because it's Juilliard. And when they called me and told me I made, like, the last round and I needed to come in for an interview, I told them, any minute, my wife is going to have a child, so I can't do that. And I was like, oh, they're not going to pick me. But I got a call, and I was just getting ready to put some ribs into the smoker, and they called me and told me I was in. I did, like, a lap around the restaurant that I was having. And 2 days later, Megan gave birth to my daughter. And then the big process of moving to New York happened. We had no money, didn't have great credit, which apparently you need money and credit to get an apartment. I should have known that. I went to New York before them to kind of set things up, like 3 weeks before. For 3 weeks, I could not find anything. And then they came down, and for like 2 or 3 days, we were just kind of roaming the streets looking for apartments that we couldn't afford. And come Friday, I was like, yo, if we don't find anything today, I don't have money to kind of sit in a hotel. We're going to be homeless for a weekend. I just got to send you back, and then we'll have to do the whole semester apart, which would not be good.
Oh, yeah, that would be
it would have been
so
bad.
Hard with a newborn.
And then a friend of mine called and said, hey, you're just looking in the wrong area. You just need to find a cheaper place to live, which might be a rougher neighborhood, but that's what it is. And I was thinking, yo, that's not going to happen. I'm not going to be able to find that place. I've been here for 3 weeks and no one's giving me anything. How am I going to? It's 3 o'clock on Friday. Somebody's giving me an apartment in 2 hours. She was like, just try. Come on out here. I know a guy. And I was ready to give up. And I give it to her. My wife was like, let's just do it because I don't want to do this time apart. So let's have faith here and just go. So I remember riding on down to East New York on the train. She fell asleep on my shoulder. My brother who was moving with me fell asleep on my shoulder. My baby was asleep. And all these people just leaning on me. And I'm like, oh, I've just ruined all our lives on this little dream that I have. We're all homeless now. And we get there and it's not, you know, the apartment's very nice. The neighborhood, a little rougher, but the apartment was good. And well, the apartment was good minus the mice. We found out that mice eat through new construction. So we had like 70 mice.
That year. God.
But, you know, we had a place to stay. And
mice indoors as opposed to outdoors.
Mice indoors, unfortunately, I wish they were stay outdoors. And I started Juilliard, and things kind of just thank goodness took off from there.
I mean, being a new parent is great, but it's very hands on, and it gives the concept of full time a whole new meaning. How did you make that work in a new city, one that famously never sleeps, and the opportunity of a lifetime to pursue your big dream? I mean, a dream that you felt was passing you by when you had been working in your restaurant job, but your restaurant job paid money, and this new dream, this dream that you're pursuing at Juilliard, is one that I'm guessing required really intense commitment and effort on your part.
Yes. I'm sitting there trying to come up with ways that I did that, which there's a couple of ways I did that, but that is useless trying to figure out how I did that because I didn't really do that. My wife did that. She wasn't working at the time, and she's from Hutch, which is a smaller town, and she kind of dropped everything at the time she was going to school. Right before he left, she was going to school full time. She had a couple jobs. She goes, and now she goes. She goes. And she dropped all that, and she moved to New York for me, for us, but for me, to pursue this dream, and stayed at home with this child, which was not easy, in a neighborhood that she was not familiar with, in a world that she was not familiar with. And she did that for several years. And so that's how that was able, because without her doing that, this doesn't happen, at least not that way. There's another route I have to go. But I was able to move to New York, go to Juilliard, and she is 99.8.7% of why I had that happened. So
you both, I mean, had been living in Kansas towns at points. I mean, you were in Manhattan, Kansas, studying theater.
Mm-hmm.
You have now studied theater in two Manhattans, a cheap comparison and observation, but it seems I am curious about how those two theater education worlds are different from one another.
Wow. The biggest difference is the cities themselves. The two Manhattans are nothing alike.
Yeah, nothing.
Just nothing alike. Minus their name, Manhattan. But one is just, I mean, it could be night and day going from one to the other. And the training, it's just the theater that's in New York. It's theirs. It's a lot of theaters, a lot of stuff going on. And a lot of the lessons you learn in writing and in theater are learned just watching shows, or learned with, you know, the playwrights, the other playwrights that you meet and you come in contact with and reading their work. It's just not there in Manhattan. It's you know, Manhattan is a smaller town outside of the university. There's not a lot of, I think there's a community center that does theater. But other than that, there's just not as much there. And the diversity is another, like, you just get different kinds of people.
In New York.
It's, you know, it felt like I was in a dimensional, you know, some kind of a dimensional time machine type of thing when I would go from the Upper West Side, where Juilliard was, back home to East New York. And it was just a train. But that train, like, it was, when I got off of one stop, oh my gosh, it was different. Like the way Upper West Side looks compared to East New York, it was you would think you literally traveled around the world because it was so different.
When you came back, I mean, you've come back to Kansas City as a writer in residence for KC Rep. Talk to me about that decision to come back and be here for a while.
LA got weird. Some of me,
So you went from New York to L.A.?
I went from New York to L.A. We went to New York to Juilliard, then kind of started writing in television, which is where I met Chael in Southland. And then I got some jobs that just were not the best situation for me, and I did not handle them the best way, and kind of got upset and frustrated with writing for television and writing in L.A. and just needed a break. My wife had had enough of traveling, doing what I wanted to do, and she was starting her degree for library sciences. So we decided to come back home, kind of get our feet planted again. And in that time, this opportunity popped up at the Rep. Some of the folks at the Rep let me know, hey, there's this grant, seemed like you'd be right for it. It just required you to kind of be here. And I said, oh, that's no problem with me. And we applied for the grant and got it. And soon after we got the grant, the opportunity in LA popped up again, and they've been kind of the Rep to let me go back and forth a little bit. It just takes a little, you know, communication, and takes a little plotting and planning so I can do both. So.
How has Kansas City changed in the time you've been gone?
Oh, wow. It's more stuff. Like, in the time I've been, even before I went to K-State, just thinking about what that area over there, the Legends area, looked like. It was nothing. It was just an empty field that wasn't there. So it's grown that way. Also, my perception of it is different. I look at Kansas City differently now since I've left. And the areas that, and the people that I meet. I don't know how much Kansas City has changed versus how my perception of Kansas City has changed, because my perception was like Wyandotte County, and that's all. And that's where I went to school. That's where I lived. That's where my friends were. And now I have friends throughout the city, and I have a better understanding of what the entire city is like.
What do you see that you didn't see before?
I don't know. I hate to go with that, but one of the big things, sorry, whatever. One of the big things is, growing up, I thought I lived in like a black city. I thought I didn't understand the makeup of the city. And not just that, it wasn't just a racial makeup, but it was also economic. All that I didn't get. I was in a little bubble. And now I realize that's not quite what I thought it was. Even like, I'm a big Chiefs fan. I go to Chiefs games.
You're wearing a Chiefs jersey.
I'm wearing a Chiefs shirt right now.
They're
going to do it big this weekend, guys. They're going to do it big this weekend. Get ready. But just going to the game, I'm looking at the people that support the city, it doesn't look like what I thought it looked like growing up. When I'm in theater and I go and I look at the audience, when we go to shows, the audience looks a certain way that I didn't think our city looks like.
Well, we'll get right back to this conversation with Nathan Lewis Jackson. He's the writer in residence for the KC Rep, and he also writes for the series Luke Cage. We're going to get back to that series when Central Standard returns. I'm Gina Kaufman. I'm Gina Kaufman. This is KCUR's Central Standard, and I'm talking to Nathan Lewis Jackson. He's a Kansas City native. He's been telling us about his upbringing in Kansas City, Kansas, and the new perspective he's had on Kansas City since he returned as writer-in-residence for the KC Rep. He'd been off in New York, where he went to pursue an education at Juilliard after having worked in a barbecue pit, as the name indicates, back here. And he's gone to L.A. to write for television. But he's back, and part of what he's doing right now is writing for the Netflix Marvel series Luke Cage. I want to get back to that because a lot of our listeners probably watched that series. Mm-hmm. We did ask them if they had questions about it for you. Great. Welcome back, Nathan.
Thank you.
So here are some questions that we've got from our listeners. One is from someone on Facebook who said he was curious about the challenges of trying to fit the series into the already mostly established Marvel universe. And by that, I think he's referring to the on-screen Marvel universe, because obviously Luke Cage, the superhero himself, had made an appearance in the comics in the 1970s.
That's probably the only challenge, I think, of that show, because Marvel was great about letting us have a lot of freedom. And when it comes to characters, when it comes to the way the show looks, the way the show feels, the way the show sounds, it was entirely up to us, and they trusted us, and it was great. The only bump would have been any conflicts in the Marvel universe. And I think there's a certain amount of keeping things separate that they want to do, and not to bump up on other ideas, because they have a lot of stuff going on. So we don't always know what's going on in other parts of the universe, or other parts of other movies that they're doing, or the TV shows.
Sort of like in the real world.
So it was just a matter of communication, and sometimes we may write something and then figure out later, wait, we can't use that because that's already being used here.
Can you give an example of that?
Oh, I don't know if I can.
But just like,
I think I could say, like, even with some of the movie stuff, we do try to, there was an idea of how we would mix the movie stuff with the TV stuff, and that didn't quite happen the way some of us wanted it to, but it just didn't happen. So if you look at the television show, there's not a lot of references from the films, and that's a Marvel Universe thing. I would love to see an appearance by Tony Stark in the show. I don't hold your breath. I don't think that's ever going to happen.
Iron Man.
Yeah, that'd be great. But I stuff like that, I think we are our own entity. We are our show, and that's what that is. And some of the film stuff is what the film stuff is. And, you know, one day maybe when, I don't know how that goes, but, you know, yeah.
We have a listener who wants to know what Luke's biggest aha moment was in his evolution through season one.
What
is the biggest aha moment for you?
For me?
Yeah.
Aha. Wow. That's a toughie. Because we had a few. The writing is all about discovery, and we're sitting in a room a lot of times. We have those moments. I will say probably some of the stuff with the way we handled female characters. And at one point, without trying, I realized we had this scene between three or four African-American females, we'll say females of color. I think it was maybe four. And it was like, we never do that. And they're not talking about men. They're not talking about love. They're just talking about what's going on in the show. And that was great.
They're doing their jobs.
They're just being characters. They just all happen to be females of color. And that was fantastic. That was a great moment.
We have someone who wants to know about action in the show, and why there isn't more focus on action.
I don't know. I think we have a decent amount of action. We don't have the amount of action that Daredevil has. And I think it's just a matter of they're two different shows, as opposed to Jessica Jones, in my opinion, has a different feel when it comes to action because of the nature of that show. So every show has a different kind of feeling to it. And I think it's just a matter of where we wanted to put our focus.
Our listeners also want to ask you about race and development in Kansas City. I think a lot of people were taken by your observations about Kansas mm-hmm. City. A listener via Twitter says, Nathan spoke about the racial divide in Kansas City. I think that we are a community that desires to move past that. Ideas for how we do that?
Good question. Yeah, I think we have a desire to move past it. I think the first step is, it sounds so cliche, but the first step is education and knowledge. And that's not just with like looking on Facebook or, you know, it's the knowledge that's out there right now in other people. Like, how much do you know about your fellow man, and how many assumptions are you making? I tend to find when the racial divide comes with a certain amount of fear and a certain amount of ignorance, and those both can be, you can eliminate that to a certain extent if you just get to know the people around you and don't get locked up in your own world. Like I said, all of my stereotypes and all of my fears kind of helped. They went out the door a little bit once I started branching out from my area that I grew up in. So I just ask that you, that's the first step, is to get to know the people around you and not just like one person around you. Just to know, like I hear people say something, oh, I have a black friend. Well, you have one black friend. I don't know who that one dude is, and he probably isn't a great representation of everyone. I'm not a great representation of the whole African-American community. In order to understand the African-American community, you need a larger sample size. So you need to go talk to several different people. Same with the Latino community. The same thing with a man who doesn't understand women. Go talk to women. There's a lot of women out there. Talk to them. The people who don't understand the gay community. Get out there and live life, and live life with the people that are around you, and then start there, I would say.
You just referenced that you grew up with your own fears and your own stereotypes mm-hmm. that came from being in a very enclosed world.
Yeah.
What were those? You've talked about that you got beyond them by moving into a larger world, but.
Oh, man. I remember growing up. Because that's like a 18, 20 minute question, but.
We'll start.
I remember growing up and listening in my car. I had this terrible little raggedy little blue Ford Festive, and I would roll the windows up when I would listen to certain kinds of music because I didn't think that I was supposed to be listening to certain, like Journey. I got a Journey CD. I was like, yo, Steve Perry's killing it right now. I love this. And I remember listening to it with the windows up because I can't have my boys hear me rocking out to Steve Perry though. So, and then I met other people, black people, who were like, yo, I love Journey too. And then I would meet white folks who would say, you love Journey? I'm like, I love Journey. And I'm like, you like Digital Underground? You like this? What? You're white though. And then, so that was like high school. And I learned that in high school, that like, wait a minute. So you don't have to be put in this little box. Like, you can be your own person. Wow. And I think sometimes we get into that where we think just because, and it's, again, it's so basic. And people say, oh, no, I don't think that. Well, take a step back and see if you actually think that. Even with this election that just happened, and a lot of my friends are like, well, this person probably voted this way because they feel this way. I'm like, wait, we're putting ourselves in boxes already. Don't assume anything about anybody off the top. Just meet them and then talk to them. And then once you talk to them, meet them, then you can start making choices and making judgment on them. Whatever.
I mean, yeah, I have so much more that I want to ask you. I wish that we had 2 hours because, yeah, it's been great getting to talk to you.
Well, it's been great to be here.
Our time is up. Nathan Lewis Jackson is a writer in residence at the KC Rep, and he's one of the writers for a really impressive Netflix series in collaboration with Marvel called Luke Cage. Check it out. And Nathan, thank you again. Thank you so much.
Thank you.
This has been a portrait session, which means photographs of Nathan by Paul Andrews will be available online with this interview at kcur.org. Take a look at our entire portrait session collection while you're there. It's pretty cool. We've talked to some of the most interesting people in Kansas City, and we're going to find lots more interesting people in Kansas City. You can tweet us your recommendations. We're at KCURCST. KCUR's Central Standard is produced by Matthew Long Middleton, Sylvia Maria Gross, Jen Chen, Andrea Tudhope, and Suzanne Hogan, with help from intern Aaron Pelish. Linda Scher runs the board for us every day. Our theme music is by Spoonbender Labs, and our portrait session partner is Paul Andrews. I'm Gina Kaufman. Have a great weekend, everyone.